Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this week's episode of the Big Bang and Creationism podcast. Before I get into the topic of this week's podcast, which is going to take up the entirety of the show, I'm going to just get the contact information out of the way and talk a little bit about last week's episode before I move on. So if you have any questions, comments, concerns that you want to let me know, you can email me at rlippens, L-I-P-P-E-N-S, at wavecable.com, or you can visit the blog, which is linked, I believe, on the iTunes website. If you click on webpage there, it'll lead you to the website. And we also have a forum that has been getting a little more activity as of late. But if you want to go discuss some ideas with other people who listen to the show, or just talk with them, you can go to the forum, and that's also linked on the website, as I was saying. Now, in regards to last week's podcast, last week I had mentioned that I had made a little mistake in the one prior to that. Well, this week I guess I had a little slip of words. A listener informed me that I had stated that relativity allowed us to go back in time. Time dilation, that is. There are certain features of relativity that do allow us to go back in time, but I believe I said that time dilation meant that we were going back in time. The fact that we age slower was like we were going back in time, but that isn't correct. In fact, we only go forward in time using time dilation, but we just go forward at a slower rate, comparatively, than others do. So time dilation does not allow us to go back in time, it just allows us to age relatively slower than the rest of the people alive. Now this week there's going to be no separate creationist claim, because this whole episode is going to be a creationist claim, and as you might see, this is just going to be part one in a few parts I'm going to have dealing with this specific book. This whole podcast is going to be dedicated to refuting the claims in a specific anti-Darwinian book I read. And the reason I say anti-Darwinian versus anti-evolution is, well, if when I introduce the author and what his claims are, you'll see in a minute why I wouldn't do justice to him or why people would say I'm misrepresenting him by claiming that he was anti-evolution when he is just anti-Darwinian evolution. So, in regards to this book, at my local library, I had seen it sitting on the shelf before, and this book is called Shattering the Myths of Darwinism. And I had thought about checking it out a few times, but I never actually did. I was too interested in looking at the physics books or the philosophy books. But now I figured it'd be a good topic for the show, so I started to get reading it. And this is the first book I've decided to study really in depth, look at the claims in depth so that I could go through it, pick out every single claim, and find the flaws in it, if there were flaws in it. If there aren't flaws, I'm not going to make some up in order to salvage my show or salvage a claim. I'm going to go where the science leads me. And so far, the science has led me to where I thought it would lead me, that the man's claims are wrong and outdated. Now, this book is by a man named Richard Milton. And he runs a website, alternativescience.com. He's a member of Mensa, as well as the Geologist Society. Now, he states that he is critical, not of evolution, which is why I didn't say he was trying to defeat evolution itself here, but the, and I quote, Darwinian mechanism of chance mutation coupled with natural selection. So the main mechanism behind natural selection, behind evolution, which is these chance mutations being driven by natural selection. He's critical of that, but not of the idea of evolution. So this might be more like an intelligent design claim that he's making here, instead of a creationist claim. He even says in the book that he does not argue that the Earth is 6,000 years old, and he isn't trying to do that, though he will borrow, and he makes it clear that he's going to borrow some of the arguments from creationist circles. Now, right away, I noticed that Milton was asking some pretty strange questions for a guy who is supposed to be... He supposedly had studied evolution for a decade or so. And he begins by asking some strange questions. For instance, in the beginning, he starts talking about changes in skin color for an example of evolution being from chance mutation guided by natural selection. And then he asks, why does the fossil record not show us such accidents happening in the past? In other words, how come skin color is not preserved in the fossil record? Well, the answer to this is quite simple. Skin color isn't going to be preserved in the fossil record, and why would it? Soft tissue, as I've stated time and time again, is not something that's easily preserved in the fossil record, and if it is preserved, it's not going to be in the form of, well, I can tell which skin color it is. No, we're just going to find the tissue there. It's not going to be colored in a relative to what it was when the creature was alive. It's going to be, basically, it's going to be fossilized. And so asking this question right away made me think right away that Richard Milton might not know all that much about evolution, in spite of him saying that he'd studied it for a decade. Now, shortly after bringing up this strange question, he raises a straw man form of uniformitarianism by stating that it doesn't make any room for catastrophe. Now, for those of you who haven't listened to the earlier episodes, I did briefly talk about uniformitarianism. What uniformitarianism is this view of geology that slow, steady processes are the main cause of the accumulation of sediments on planet Earth. So, versus the catastrophist view, which is, boom, all of this happened all at once, and all these layers were just put down in some catastrophic event. And what Milton doesn't seem to understand is that uniformitarianism does leave room for catastrophes. Obviously, catastrophes have happened all over the Earth's history. For instance, the Chicxulub, I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, an impact on the Yucatan Peninsula about 65 million years ago that wiped out all the dinosaurs. That's an example of a catastrophe that has happened over Earth's history. But that doesn't negate the fact that uniformitarianism occurs. So I don't see why he's saying that he's assuming that it only allows this gradual process, and any kind of catastrophic event has no effect whatsoever. Well, it does have an effect, but the main cause of the accumulation of sediment is uniformitarianism. And then this kind of leads him into his next statement, which is, he wonders, how can we have this uniformitarianism-like process when we have these so-called polystrate fossils, which are supposed to be some kind of detriment to uniformitarianism? Now, what polystrate fossils are ones that stick up through multiple layers of soil or sediment, and usually they stick up through multiple layers of coal seams. So, because first, we see that Milton says that uniformitarianism is this process that only occurs when catastrophes don't occur, which, of course, we know they do. Then he brings up polystrate fossils and says, therefore, that uniformitarianism is wrong, because trees can't stand on their end for millions of years while this sediment accumulates. So, the fossil Milton uses as an example of his polystrate fossil, he uses a tree. And aside from one whale that really wasn't a polystrate fossil, all they have to mention for polystrate fossils are trees. So, this tree was found standing 38 feet tall in a coal seam in Lancashire. Now, we do know that there are many types of these polystrate tree fossils. In fact, we have whole forests of polystrate tree fossils that have been preserved in various locations. And we've known polystrate fossils to exist since the 19th century, and even then they did not pose a problem for the view of uniformitarianism. First of all, there isn't some worldwide layer of coal that corresponds to the seam found in Lancashire. It's an isolated local event. It's not as if the entire Earth were added, not if an entire layer of the Earth were added at some magically short time. Now, second, most of these areas where these fossils are found, as I stated before, are found in coal seams. For instance, the Joggins Formation in Nova Scotia, as well as this Lancashire one. And the rapid deposition of soil, water, the movement of salt in the case of the Joggins Formation, or any other catastrophic event that would not knock over the trees, can be seen as the mechanism behind the formation of these fossil forests. Notice that these fossil forests do not occur everywhere on Earth. They are isolated events. Again, this is local catastrophes that he's trying to say, that Milton is trying to say, should usurp this notion of uniformitarianism. What he's doing is saying, basically, that we have, for instance, volcanic eruptions, which are local catastrophic events, and these local catastrophic events should demonstrate that uniformitarianism, which is a gradual worldwide soil deposition process, they're saying that volcanic eruptions, since they're catastrophic, show that uniformitarianism is wrong, and of course, this is not true. Now, also, I'd like to note that I became aware, after checking out Milton's sources, that he most likely, or that he most often relied on data that was about 40 years old. From the time of him writing his book, that's about 30 years old, because he put out his first book in 1992, I believe, and did the second edition in 1997. But instead of using newer work that disproved his arguments, he tended to use the older work that looked like it hadn't been disproven yet. For instance, he uses a paper on, when talking about radiometric dating, he uses a paper from 1963, and when a paper in 1965, and in fact, the 1963 paper itself offered an explanation that Milton left out, but the 1965 paper clarified the 1963 result. So, he uses old data most of the time, and this old data has been refuted by data that's newer. And it has been out in the time that Milton has been able to do his research for the most part. There are a few, one so far that I've found that Milton wouldn't have been able to refute because the information hadn't been out yet. But his claim is therefore still outdated. Moving away from uniformitarianism, Milton now goes to the abiogenesis or origin of life claims. And like most people who disagree or argue against abiogenesis who are maybe from the intelligent design movement or creationists, he's going to use, of course, probability arguments, and I expected that. So, the scientific paper he uses to discuss his probability claims is one written by a Murray Eden, who was an MIT professor at the time. I don't know if he still is. And this paper stated that the odds of spontaneously forming molecules, fully formed ones, was about one time every 1 billion years. Now, first of all, and I don't know how many times I'm going to say this throughout the course of the history of the show, abiogenesis doesn't entail the spontaneous formation of anything. I'm not sure if Milton means spontaneous generation, so I'm going to be careful the way I word this, but it seems like he does when he writes, and I quote, "Darwinian view is that although the formation of protein molecules without any precursor is highly improbable, it could have occurred, given enough time, hundreds of millions of years." So he's assuming that the Darwinian model, which, of course, abiogenesis doesn't have anything to do with evolution, but he's saying that the model involves this spontaneous formation of protein molecules, which it really doesn't. There are chemical precursors that lead to it. Secondly, as I was saying about outdated information, the Murray Eden paper was written in 1967, and it's extremely out of date, not to mention it was discredited in a period of discussion that was present in the exact same paper. In particular, it was found that Murray Eden's choice of numbers was pretty arbitrary, and he didn't explain it. He also states in the paper that maybe functionally useful proteins are very common in a certain area. He gave a number, but I don't want to throw the number out because it's very large and creationists like to quote it. But in this certain space, these protein molecules, fully formed, would be fairly common. And Milton neglects to mention this when he uses Eden as a source. But the fact is that there are many abiogenesis models now, and the probability that Murray Eden used, he was arbitrary in it. It wasn't explained, and so I, for one, and most scientists, would not use this number as a probability behind abiogenesis because it has no reasoning. There's no reasoning behind it. Milton then claims that life could not have formed in the time allotted now. He's using the number he got beforehand to build more onto this kind of straw man of abiogenesis. This time he takes one paper from the 1980s, which is newer, I'll give him that, and it states that the oceans formed around 3.8 billion years ago, and then he takes one other paper, which says evidence for life existed 3.8 billion years ago, and says that if you do the math, you end up with zero time in order to have life. Well, I kind of find this ironic because, well, in the next section we'll see that he doesn't agree with radiometric dating at all, and yet he's using the dates acquired by radiometric dating here in order to say that life could have no time to form. So he's kind of using stuff that he doesn't believe is correct in order to prove a point that he's trying to make about evolution, abiogenesis being incorrect. So he's kind of confusing there. Now, new data came up after Milton Second Publishing, so we can't really blame Milton for this, came up in 2001, which gives evidence for the oceans actually being formed a few million years ago after the formation of the Earth. What we found is some zircon, which is about 4.4 billion years old, which shows evidence of there being water present on the Earth. So, in spite of this new data, though, the fact that Milton was using flawed paper to calculate his odds, and the fact that he's using radiometric dating, which he believes to be flawed, those kind of disprove his argument right there. Once again, after this, Milton brings up more probability. This time he says that a protein containing 100 amino acids forming spontaneously couldn't have occurred given so much time. The odds of it are so low. Well, once again, we don't require spontaneous generation. We don't expect 100 amino acids to randomly form in, you know, a split second, and then we have poof, our fully formed protein. That's not our view of a biogenesis. We have simple chemical precursors leading to replicating polymers, and then it'll go on from there. We don't have simple chemicals, poof, fully formed life. This seems to be a common straw man of the view of a biogenesis. I mean, I might not be understanding what Milton is saying correctly, but from what I'm reading, it sounds like he's implying spontaneous generation of protein chemicals. For the last section of claims brought up by Milton this week, we're going to be discussing a bit about the geologic column. Now, the geologic column is a way of assigning time to different layers of strata in the Earth's history. It's composed of multiple eons, eras, and periods, which are all defined by varying layers of strata. They're chosen, the names are arbitrary, of course, but these correspond to different layers of strata that we can see. Now, Milton says that we don't know the ages of these different layers because the column is composed of sedimentary rock and we can't date it. Well, that's true, we can't date sedimentary rock. And he goes on to say that, well, we can radiometric date igneous rock and we find it within the layers. But he says that we can't actually tell the ages of these layers by dating the igneous rock because it's so rare and it could have, well, somehow intruded upon a layer. I don't see how dating sedimentary rock with igneous rock in the same layer is incorrect. They're both laid down at the same time, and therefore they're both going to be of the same age, and that's going to be the column, age of the column, by dating these igneous rocks. And if they do intrude, well, that's obviously a rare occurrence, and we can check this by dating multiple ones to see if we get a common age. So, I don't quite see how dating the column using what is in it, what is in a specific strata, to be a problem. So, it doesn't seem to make any sense, his argument here. Next, Milton falsely claims, and I see this a lot in creationist circles, that the geologic column doesn't exist anywhere on Earth, that it's purely some mythical fantasy of Darwinian evolutionists. Now, the true fact behind this is that the geologic column is known to exist in at least 26 places around the world in full. Now, a common objection to this I was seeing when I was typing in geologic column on Google and doing a bit of research for the show is that the question of a supposed refutation of these 26 places being full columns comes up. I went to trueorigins.com, which is kind of a counter site to Talk Origins, and this creationist website was saying that while the North Dakota column, which is one of the places that this full column exists, Williston Basin, North Dakota, and this column's about 15 to 16 miles deep when it was fully drilled, this hypothetical column that the evolutionists predict is somewhere around 200 miles deep, and so we can't consider North Dakota, the column of North Dakota, to be a full column. For the column to be off this much, I was a bit confused as to why we can consider this a full column. I emailed the USGS, as well as Britain's Geological Service. Britain's Geological Service got back to me first and said the question was a bit tough, and I'd probably have to do the research myself. And USGS didn't get back to me yet, so I went along, I wanted to get the show out, so I kind of neglected to see if the USGS wrote me back. I checked this morning, and they didn't, so the show will be out before they write me, if they write me back. because they said they didn't answer some questions. But when the creationists make up their hypothetical column, what I found was that what they were taking was the thickest amounts of sediment on Earth for certain strata. So, for instance, all over the world we have different thickness of the strata. We don't have an onion layer Earth. But they take the thickest layer of strata, so, say, in Africa, in this certain region, the thickness of the Cambrian is 15,000 meters deep. But in this other place, it's 10,000 meters deep. In this place, it's 2 meters deep, or something like that. Well, what they would do is they'd take the thickest region, which would be, in our hypothetical example, in Africa, and then they'd take, say, the Silurian period. And it was 20,000 meters deep in one place and 2,000 meters deep in the other place. Well, they'd take the 20,000, and they'd take the 15,000, and they'd do that for the rest of the strata layers that are, which are supposed to be in the geologic column. And they'd take these, and they'd add them all up. And they'd say, well, if you add up the thickest area, the thickest depth for all these strata, and you add them up, you'll get 200 miles. And what they say is, well, the North Dakota sediment is not actually as thick as the one we found here. So obviously it's not the full column. Well, this is a rather dishonest tactic, and from what I understand, no geologist would actually use this definition of the geologic column. Of course, the height of these different strata are going to vary all over the Earth. They're not going to be the same. There are local weather changes and local patterns and local catastrophic events that are going to change the thickness of each sediment. So, it doesn't really make any sense to claim that the Earth should be layered like an onion and we should all have a certain layer and it should be 100 miles or 200 miles deep and this is the thickness of each sediment and if it's not this thick, it's not the true column. So, by adding up the thickest layers in each region, we can get this outrageously large number of 200 miles deep, but we never actually find this in nature, and no geologist predicts this kind of thickness for the depth of the geologic column. Milton seems to be relying on this hypothetical geologic column that creationists make when he states that the Cretaceous sediment should be about 15,000 meters thick. He never states where he gets this number, but I'm supposing he's drawing this data from his hypothetical creationist geologic column. And after that, we would move on to radiometric dating, but that is going to require a whole show in itself. His claims about radiometric dating are pretty large, and I did fairly extensive research on trying to see what the refutations were for his various claims. So that's going to be the end of, I guess, part one of Shattering the Myths of Darwinism, which is the book by Richard Milton. So to conclude this episode, I guess we're going to do a little bit of recap on what the one main problem of the book was. First of all, I'm only 30 pages into the book. What we discussed was only about 30 pages of book's worth. And so far, none of Milton's claims have actually been a problem for evolution or any other science. He relies on information that is outdated and will seem to ignore findings that refute his claims that are available. Now, next week's episode, as I stated before, is going to be a refutation, again, of more of Milton's book. That's going to be focusing on the claims he makes about radiometric dating because he says that we can't actually know the age of the Earth and that radiometric dating is flawed and scientifically inaccurate. So we're going to check up on those claims and see if they hold any ground. Well, that's all for this week. Everyone, have a good week, and we will talk next time.